Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Happy Sabbath to you all. Nice to be with you today. I was very happy that he went ahead and read the announcement for the young adults. I consider myself to be in that category, so I was happy to hear that. Nice to be with you. Do appreciate the chance to come over and visit with you every so often. That's one of the things we enjoy, my wife and I, about being in the headquarters office, is the chance to get out and visit other congregations occasionally, and we always enjoy coming here to Fort Worth. I want to start off today. Let's see if we can get this switched over here. All right. I want to start by talking about a biblical mystery, and this is something that happened within the last few years. Jerusalem is a fascinating city. It is, in many ways, one of the most important cities in the world. There are many interesting places to visit in and around Jerusalem. Of course, you've got the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount. You've got the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You've got the walls around the outside. You've got the Western Wall, as it's called now, what used to be called the Wailing Wall, and which is the holiest site to Judaism. One of the interesting places also that you can visit there is a park. And the park looks like this. It's quite a pleasant park. They have concerts there at different times in the year. It's a very lush green park, as you can see. And oftentimes when I've guided groups of young people through Jerusalem, as we've had the chance to do several times, I will take them here for a picnic. And as we're enjoying the lush surroundings, I begin explaining to them, as we're munching on our sandwiches, what this valley is. And in fact, this is the Valley of Hinnom. And as I explain to them what the Valley of Hinnom was and what it likely will be again in the future, they start usually getting a little bit uneasy and looking around like, are we really supposed to be here? The Valley of Hinnom, you will recall, is what Jesus referred to as Gehenna. And this is probably the place where the Lake of Fire is actually going to be at in this future time. But right now, it's a very pleasant park, and I've enjoyed having picnics here on a number of occasions. You can see on the screen here, this is a map of Jerusalem, obviously. You can see the old city over here. This is the part that causes all the trouble. This is where the Temple Mount is. This is where the old walls are around the city. And just below, right along here, just below Mount Zion, is where, in fact, we have the Valley of Hinnom. And in one side of the Valley of Hinnom, something interesting was found. In 1979, an archaeological excavation was taking place at a site called Ketef Hinnom, southwest of the old city of Jerusalem. Ketef means shoulder. So this was the shoulder of the Valley of Hinnom, and it's at one end of the valley. This is, as I mentioned before, the place that Jesus referred to as Gehenna, because at his time, this was a dump. The valley was a dump, and there was garbage being dumped out there. And so the fires were burning continuously. There was always smoke rising from the Valley of Hinnom, from Gehenna. And in some cases, even the bodies of detested criminals would be thrown there. They weren't given a proper burial. They'd just be dumped out in the garbage, in the refuse. And so ending up in Hinnom, or Gehenna, was a very odious end. It was a shameful place to end one's life. But in this archaeological excavation that was happening at Ketef Hinnom, they were excavating what had been a tomb, and that was one of the things that was being excavated here. There was an archaeologist named Gabriel Barkay who was working that year, 1979, with some archaeologists who were assisted by 12, 13, 14-year-old volunteer students from a local club. And in fact, what they were excavating was something that looked like this. What you can see here, this is actually a burial chamber. It would have been covered, and the roof had fallen in on top of it. Let me explain a little bit about how people were buried. Here are some students demonstrating how things would have been handled in the first century. Nowadays, we put people in a box, we usually bury them, and that's it. They stay there in the box, and the body slowly decomposes. In Europe, customs are different. In Europe, you only rent the spot for 50 years. And after that, they either dig you up, or you can rent it again for 50 more years, or they dig you up and put you someplace else. But in first century Palestine, what happened when people died was that the body would be placed. Of course, they didn't have embalming the way that we would have bodies embalmed today. So they would place them in a tomb, and they would basically just close the door and let nature run its course. Then about a year later, they would open the tomb up. The flesh would have been decomposed by that time, and they would gather up the bones, and they would put them in a much smaller box. Of course, all you need is a box the length of a femur, and you find these burial boxes even today. Archaeologists will find them. They're about so long, maybe something like that. And the bones would be removed, and then the tomb could be reused once again. That's why you'll recall when Jesus was placed in the tomb that it was specifically mentioned that no one had ever lain in that tomb before. You remember in John 19:41, it says, "Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid." That was an exceptional thing because mostly people were placed in tombs that were used over and over and over again. Well, that's what you see on the screen here. This is where the bodies would have been placed, and it would have been covered. It was actually a sort of a cave-like thing originally, and that ceiling had disappeared. And so these young assistant archaeologists were sent in to clean out this burial chamber. Dr. Barkay sent a young archaeologist and three junior high students to clean out one of the burial caves. And as he sent them off, he specifically said, "Remember, archaeology is not a treasure hunt." But these young archaeologists were going to find one of the most amazing treasures of biblical history as they went to this site. In fact, what they found was that the ceiling had fallen and it had become mixed in with the floor. And there was actually a part of the burial chamber that went farther down, but it was unknown to them because the ceiling had fallen down on top of it. And that's where these young people began digging. To give you an idea of what they found, this has been put in a museum, and you see what they found was that this whole central section here had been unknown prior to that time. Everything had been kind of packed down on top of it. It seemed just like a floor. But as they began digging down into it, you notice they found all sorts of a veritable treasure trove of ancient artifacts were found in this section. So here, this is a slide of some of the things that were found. Did I get the right picture there? Here we are. This was actually on the site where they were digging through this and using their archaeologist tools to excavate pieces of pottery and all sorts of interesting ancient artifacts. Then, as they were working, a 13-year-old girl, originally from Toledo, Ohio, her name was Judy Hadley, she walked up to Dr. Barkay and she handed him an object about the size of a cigarette. He looked closely at this object. It looked about like this at the time. He looked closely at it, and he began to get excited because he recognized it as an amulet scroll. He was aware of these things. He knew what it was. An amulet scroll was a rolled-up piece of silver with writing engraved on the inside. And such amulets were sacred objects that were worn by the Levitical priests. So it would have been part of their costume. They would either hang on their clothing or they would wear them. And ultimately, as they went through what they were finding in this excavation, they found two amulets. And of course, what they didn't realize at the time is that Judy had just made one of the most important discoveries in the history of biblical archaeology. Those amulets were going to send shockwaves through the world of archaeology and biblical studies. The amulets were offered to experts of several universities and museums around the world to have them unrolled, but none of them would accept. The operation seemed too delicate. No one wanted to accidentally destroy something so ancient. And finally, some Israeli experts developed a method, but it was going to take them 3 years to be able to unroll these scrolls and see what they might find on the inside. Now, 3 years is a lot of time, so we're going to pause here. We'll let them work on that for a while, and we're going to shift gears. And we'll come back at the end of the sermon and see what happened when they finally figured out a way to unroll those scrolls. Let me change gears here and talk about something else while we're letting the archaeologists work. One of the most important elements, and I'll put this on a black screen while we're thinking about something else. One of the most important elements of our relationship as humans with God is prayer. We understand that God communicates to us when we read and study His Word, and we talk to Him through prayer. That's how we converse with God. And it shouldn't be surprising to us that there are many examples of prayer in the Bible. There are many instructions about prayer in the Bible. God doesn't leave us without guidance in knowing how we should pray to him. So if I were to ask you, you can probably think of some prayers that you remember from the Bible. If I were to ask you, what prayers from the Bible can you call to mind right now? Who prayed them, in what occasion, and what's the gist of what they said? How many prayers like that would you be able to call to mind? Maybe you think of the prayer of Jabez in 1 Chronicles 4, verse 10, where it says, Jabez called on the God of Israel, saying, "Oh, that you would bless me indeed and enlarge my territory, that your hand would be with me, and that you would keep me from evil so that I may not cause pain." That's an interesting prayer, isn't it? And that apparently is the totality of it. And the next verse says, "So God granted what he requested." God hears our prayers, even short prayers, and he responds to those prayers. Maybe you're thinking of the prayer in Psalm 51 by a man who had just come to grips with the fact that he had committed adultery and murder and had caused the death of his baby son. And he cried out to God and said, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness. According to the multitude of your tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin." And a little later he said, "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me." That's a powerful, powerful, eloquent prayer, opening his heart and talking to God. And we know that God heard and answered that prayer as well. There are prayers in the Bible recorded for us that were given or made by ladies, by women, women of God who prayed and whom God heard and answered as well. You might think of Hannah's prayer in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11. She prayed, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." And God heard that prayer, and he answered that prayer. And she conceived a son who became Samuel, one of the great prophets and the great men of God. It's quite a fascinating study to do, to look at individual prayers that are recorded for us in the Bible. If you've never done that study yourself personally, I would encourage you to take the time to do that. It's not hard to find them with a concordance. They're very interesting examples, and we learn a lot from seeing which prayers God preserved, because he preserved them for a reason. He wants us to learn from those things, and there are lots of things that we can learn from them. When it comes to instructions about prayer in the Bible, the most important set of instructions we have were given by Jesus Christ himself when the apostles or disciples at that time came to him and said, "Teach us how to pray." And he said, "In this manner, therefore, pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen." That's often called the Lord's Prayer. Beautiful, graceful, poetic words. And I'm sure that you've all heard a sermon or a Bible study expounding this model prayer. It's the basis of most of what we pray personally, individually to God. We use that as the table of contents in our prayer. Each one of those lines is a chapter heading, and then we fill it in, and we talk to God. We open our hearts and minds and talk to him using that outline for prayer. Those are indeed beautiful, graceful, gracious, and poetic words. But did you know, brethren, that there is another prayer in the Bible also given as a model to be used by God's people? This time it was in the Old Testament. It was a model prayer that was given in what we call ancient Israel. And it also is a beautiful, graceful, and poetic prayer. And it underscores important elements of how God views his relationship with his people, and also how we, as his people, should view our relationship with him. And this is a particular kind of prayer. It's a little bit different from the Lord's Prayer because it is, in fact, a prayer asking God to do certain things for other people, a blessing on Israel. What I'm talking about is often called the Aaronic benediction, Aaronic for Aaron, who was the high priest at the time, the Aaronic benediction or blessing. And it's found in Numbers chapter 6. Turn with me there if you would. Let's go to Numbers chapter 6, and let's look at this beautiful prayer that was given to the Israelites. Numbers chapter 6, starting in verse 22. And I would suggest you may want to put the ribbon of your Bible there in Numbers 6, if you have a ribbon in your Bible, because we'll be going other places, and then we'll be coming back here several times as well. Let's read what it says here. Numbers chapter 6, verse 22. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying," so this is why it's called the Aaronic benediction. This was what the instructions to Aaron. "This is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them," so this is a prayer, but it's a special kind of prayer. Like as I said, it's a blessing prayer. So they're speaking to the children of Israel, but it's actually a prayer that's rising up before God. They're asking God to do this for the children of Israel. "Say to them," so here's the model that's given, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." Then verse 27 says, "So they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." Now this is a very interesting thing, a very interesting prayer. And there are many, many lessons and bits of information and encouragement that we can glean from it. One of the first things, one of the obvious things we see here, is God's deep desire to bless his people. Because this wasn't something that the Levites came up with. Aaron didn't say to his sons, "Oh, let's get the scroll out, let's jot down some things we'd like to ask God for the children of Israel." This is God himself who says, "I want you to pronounce this blessing on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." And this is specifically what you're supposed to say. This is specifically what you're supposed to ask me to grant to them. This is God himself who is writing this prayer. And that's why we think of it in many ways as a model prayer as well. And God promises right at the end, "This is how you put my name on the people, and I will bless them." It's God's intention to bless his people. It was his intention to bless Israel, and as we're going to see, that carries through into the New Testament church era, as well. Before we go any farther, let's ask a rather fundamental question. What is a blessing? What's a blessing? Well, the Hebrew word barakah, which is used here in this passage, means, another way of translating would be, a benefit or a gift or generous or a present, or in some cases you can even translate it as peace. So in other words, this is something good, a gift that God is going to give to his people, a gift that they otherwise would not have, something that is miraculously coming from God to people to whom he wishes to do good. That's what a blessing is. But let me ask you another question. How is it then, if that's what it means, how is it that the Bible sometimes talk about people blessing God? You sing that in hymns sometimes. "Bless the Lord eternal, O my soul." How can we bless God? Can we give him a benefit? Can we give him something he wouldn't otherwise have if we didn't give it to him? No, obviously not. So how do we bless God? What does that mean? Well, when we read about blessing God, the Hebrew word is actually a little bit different. It's not barakah, it's barak. And barak means something different. It's also translated as bless in English, but it has the meaning of congratulate or praise or salute. It's in that sense that we can bless God's name or bless God. We salute him. We honor him. We praise him. We show respect to him for the good that he is and the good that he does. So when we bless God, it's not the same procedure as when God blesses us. When we bless God's name, we're acknowledging his greatness and his goodness. When he blesses us, he's giving us some miraculous benefit that we would not otherwise have. And of course, blessing can mean different things. Blessing can be the gift that we actually receive from God, or it can be the words that we pronounce. I'm going to pronounce a blessing on you. That means the words that I'm going to speak. So it can be either of those things. In number 6, we read, it said, "This is the way you shall bless the children." So those words are a blessing, but the benefits that are received are also blessings. In the case of the Aaronic blessing or benediction, it is God who is blessing his people. He's bestowing a good on his people that they otherwise would not have. Spiritual good, physical good that God gives to be enjoyed by those he blesses. Sometimes when we think about blessings in the Bible, blessings can come in different forms and shapes, I guess you would say. Sometimes particular blessings were passed on from one generation to another. We have examples in the Bible where a blessing would go from a father to one of his sons, but not the other son. And then from that son, it would go down to one of his sons, but not the other son. It could specifically be passed down from generation to generation in a particular line of the family. And we have several examples of that. The blessing that God pronounced on Abraham went to Isaac, but not to Ishmael, his brother. And from Isaac, it went to Jacob, but not to Esau, his brother. And they were very aware of how concrete these blessings were and how they could be transmitted from one man to another. You remember in Genesis 27, Esau lamented when he realized his brother had stolen his blessing, his birthright blessing. Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob?" Which means supplanter, someone who takes somebody else's place. "For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now he has taken away my blessing." And then he asked his father, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Once that blessing was passed on from one generation to another, it couldn't be changed. They couldn't take it back, say, "Oh, I made a mistake. I'm taking it back from him, and I want to give it to him." Once it was passed on, it was passed on. And certain blessings are like that. There are individual blessings that pass from one generation to another. David noticed one such blessing. He mentions it in Psalm 37. Let's turn there. Psalm 37. David was a very astute observer of God's people and God's blessings, actually. Very aware of those things. In Psalm 37, verse 25, David wrote this, "I have been young and now I'm old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread." That's interesting. He looked, he watched, he saw God's people, he saw the Israelites, he watched generations of righteous people, and he said, "You know, I've noticed something in all my years of life. I have never seen the righteous forsaken." They have their ups and downs like everybody, but they're never just forsaken, abandoned by God. "And I've never seen their descendants begging bread." God watches over their descendants as well. Because of the righteousness, because of the example that they have set, you will not see their children or their grandchildren begging bread. And I can tell you, in the ancient world, if you study it, there was a lot of bread begging going on back there. There were a lot of people who were very poor. That was a common thing. Even today, in many places in the world, you'll see many people begging bread. But David said, "I've never seen that happen to the descendants of the righteous." That's a kind of blessing. When we are faithful to God, when we respond to him and submit to his will, he takes care of our children. He watches over them and our children's children. David said, "I've never seen the descendants of the righteous begging bread. They may not be rolling in gold, but they're not begging bread. God takes care of them." That's an individual blessing that David had observed. When we are faithful to God, he takes care of our children. There are also in the Bible collective blessings on a whole group or on a whole nation. And we have lists sometimes of blessings that were given. In the context of Israel, of course, those were the Abrahamic blessings. God made promises to Abraham, and those promises were carried out onto the Israelites. And I think you would agree that in many of our Western countries today, we're still profiting from blessings that God promised to Abraham because of his faithfulness. We enjoy some of those even now, thousands of years later, collective blessings that come on entire nations. And as we're going to see a little bit later, some of that carries over into the church era and carries over onto the church as well. There are collective blessings that we receive. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is an interesting chapter. I'm not going to turn there. You probably recognize what that means. That's one of the chapters where we have a list of blessings and cursings. God said, if you're obedient to me, you're going to have national blessings. You'll be victorious in war. You'll have good harvests. You'll have good health. There'll be peace in the land, and so on. And then after that, he said, however, if you disobey me, here are all the bad things that are going to happen to you. And you'll lose your wars, and you won't be healthy, and you won't be rich, and the rain won't come when you need it, and you'll go hungry, and et cetera, et cetera. There were national blessings that were granted to the whole nation. God does look at us individually, and he does look at us also collectively. And there can be blessings that come to us individually, even just on one person or on a family. And there can be blessings that come on the group as a whole. The church can be blessed and be guided and encouraged in its work. And there can be material blessings. We've thought about that recently because the income of the church over the last few years has gone up. Not a huge increase in members, but the income steadily increasing. We believe a lot of that is because of God's blessing on his people. Even materially, it would appear. It would appear that that's what's happening there, and we're very thankful for that. God does look at us individually, but he also looks at us collectively. And if individual Israelites were righteous, were just, then the whole nation benefited. If most people were righteous and obedient to God, the whole nation benefited. If most people were unrighteous and disobedient to God, then there were curses that came on the whole group. And I think that's interesting for us to think about, that perhaps our relationship with God and our commitment to God can help bring about blessings on the whole group. And perhaps the inverse would be true as well. One reason that I mention this is because in Numbers chapter 6, it's interesting to notice that the pronoun you, whenever it says you in the New King James, that pronoun is actually singular and not plural. Just a quick grammar reminder here. You know, there are singular pronouns and there are plural pronouns. I is a singular, first person singular. We is the first person plural. I is one person, we is more than one person. He is one person, they are more than one person. So we have singular and we have plural. We used to have a singular and plural in English as well, but we've lost our singular pronoun. We don't have a first person singular anymore, or sorry, second person singular anymore. We only have second person plural. We say you. Whether it's one of you or two or three or a crowd, we only say you. It didn't used to be that way. We used to have a singular pronoun, and it was thou. Thou, thee, thy. You remember that from the old King James? Whenever you read that, that meant only one person. That was a singular pronoun. And it's interesting when you read the old King James and you read the Aaronic benediction in Numbers chapter 6, it comes out a bit differently. In the case of the Aaronic blessing, God was blessing Israel, he said, but the blessings were directed at each individual person. In other words, God was going to bless the group by blessing each person individually in their individual relationship with God. There was going to be a spiritual and physical benefit that God would give to individual Israelites that would spill over into the whole nation. So if we read it in the Old King James, maybe some of you have it in the Old King James, it says, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, saying, in this wise you shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious to thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. This was an individual blessing granted to each individual Israelite, but the cumulative effect of it was going to be for the entire nation. And I think that's an interesting lesson for us to consider as well. When we receive individual blessings from God, We should look for ways to let that spill over out of our own lives and into the lives of other people. That's specifically what God said he was going to do here with the Aaronic benediction. Of course, when I was a kid growing up in the church, we didn't have the New King James. It was the Old King James. And so those of us who grew up in those periods, we were quite comfortable with thous and these and thys. And I remember when I got to high school and we started studying Shakespeare, some of my friends were amazed that I could navigate all of that so easily. And I said, well, I've been speaking King James since I was a kid. Because the King James Bible, you know, was translated at the same time that Shakespeare was writing. So it's basically the same kind of language that you get there. Well, with all of that said, let's take a look at the different elements that we find in Numbers 6 and see what we can learn from this particular blessing that God wrote to be used for the children of Israel. Numbers chapter 6, verse 22. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless thee, remember, individually, and keep thee. Okay, what does that mean? Well, bless, we've already looked at. It means to give a benefit. May God give you good things. May he do good to you. And may he keep you. How does God keep us? And what does that mean? What does it mean for God to keep someone? When we think about keeping, it means you're going to hang on to it with your hand and you're not going to give it away to anybody else. Is that what it means when God keeps us? Well, if you'll turn to Psalm 121, we have a pretty good illustration of how God keeps his people. Psalm 121. It specifically says here, it gives a number of examples of how God keeps his people. And what does that mean when God keeps you? Psalm 121. You'll notice at the beginning of the psalm, it says a song of ascents. A song of ascent was a particular kind of psalm that people would either sing or recite or remember as they were going up. They were ascending up to Jerusalem. You always have to go up to Jerusalem because it's high up in the mountains. As people would always ascend, you would go up to Jerusalem. And you'll find that in the Psalms a lot. I was happy when they said, let us go up to Jerusalem. You have to go up. However, going up to Jerusalem wasn't always a safe sort of thing. Some people going up to Jerusalem had to pass through the valley where the pilgrim was set upon by thieves, and the Good Samaritan had to help him out. That was a notorious passage for thieves. So people who were going up, they were looking forward to the feast days, but they were probably keeping their wits about them and looking around to make sure that no one was going to waylay them either, because that was not an uncommon occurrence. I will lift up my eyes to the hills. That's what they were doing. They're looking up. They're looking around. From whence comes my help? And they were thinking, I hope we're going to be okay going up there. Who can we count on to help us as we're going through maybe a dangerous passage on the way up to the feasts? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to be moved. He who keeps you, this is how God keeps us. He keeps us. He will not slumber. He won't let us slip and utterly fall. We'll fall sometimes and scrape our knees and have to get up and carry on. But God will not let us utterly fall. And it says, he who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. Some of the pagan nations around Israel believed that their gods could fall asleep sometimes. And so they would have to cry out very loud to wake them up and make sure that they heard whatever prayer they were asking. But the people of Israel knew that their God never slept. He would never be absent-minded about them. He was always aware of what was happening to them. That's the way God keeps us. He does neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. See, we have this once again. This is a theme that runs through this particular psalm. He is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. He'll protect you from the dangers of the day and of the night. Protect you from extremes of life that can occur. The Lord shall preserve you from all evil. He shall preserve your soul, your life. The Lord shall preserve your going out and your coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. These are blessings you can count on for the future. That's how God keeps us. He's always watching over us. Never gets absent-minded, never goes to sleep, never loses sight of us, always very aware of what we're doing, and he prevents us from falling utterly and gets us back on our feet again. This is how God keeps us. And he wants us to be reminded that he keeps us. The Lord bless and keep you. That's part of the blessing. We're supposed to remember that God does indeed keep us. He watches over us. He doesn't let our foot slip. He doesn't let us fall down the mountainside. He watches over the dangers of the night and of the day. Of course, that doesn't mean, we understand very well, it doesn't mean that we'll never die in this life, or that we'll never fall sick, or that we won't have difficulties in this life, painful situations that occur. That's all part of the human existence and the human state. But God will carry through his good work and bring us to the point where eventually he can give us eternal life. And that's the ultimate goal, of course. Back to number 6. The next part of the Aaronic benediction that we have here is, after the Lord bless and keep you, the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to have God's face shine upon us? Well, this is an obvious reference that takes us back to Exodus chapter 33, where there was a face shining that occurred. Let's go to Exodus chapter 33. Verse 12, Exodus 33, verse 12. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found grace in my sight." Moses said, I need a little clarity here. Who's coming along with us? Who's gonna guide us and make sure that we make it through the desert where we're supposed to be going? "Now, therefore, I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you, and that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people." I can't do it by myself. This is your people. You've got to be the one that guides us. "And he said," God said, "my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Then he said to him, "If your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. For how then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will also do this thing that you have spoken. For you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name." That's an interesting thought, isn't it? God knows his people by name. We're not just sort of generic human beings. He knows your first name. He knows your middle name. He knows your last name. He knows who you are. He knows what your fears are. He knows what your hopes are. He knows more about you than you know about yourself, as a matter of fact. All those things we like to hide from ourselves, he knows. We can't hide anything from him. God says, "Moses, I know you by name. I know who you are, and I'll take care of you." And he said, "Please..." So Moses is on a roll now. He's asking things, and God's answering, so he's going to go one more. "Can I see you? Would you show yourself to me? I really would like to see you." And he said, "Okay, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But he said, 'You cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live.' And the Lord said, 'Here is a place by me. You shall stand on the rock. So it shall be while my glory passes by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and will cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I will take away my hand and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen.'" It would kill you. The brilliance would just be too much. Chapter 34, verse 5. Chapter 34, verse 5. "Then the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed..." So here's a particular... This is a special gift as well. This doesn't seem to be something that Moses asked for, but it was an extra blessing that he gave. God himself is going to pronounce his own name. And he's going to let Moses see him as well. "And he proclaimed, 'The Lord.'" And when you see L-O-R-D, all capital... That means the eternal. That's the best translation of that, Yahweh, the eternal. the eternal God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. That's God's name. It's one of his names, anyway. His name is about who he is, what he is. So Moses made haste and bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped. Then he said, "If now I have found grace in your sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray, go among us, even though we are a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as an inheritance." Then there was an interesting side effect that Moses had no idea was going to happen. Exodus chapter 34, verse 29. So after this discussion that he has with God, "It was so," verse 29, "when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, and the two tables of the testimony were in Moses' hand when he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him." Moses is coming down the mountain, and everybody's backing up. What is this? Who is this? What's happened to his face? What is this power that's occurring here? They were afraid. Maybe they didn't even recognize who he was, if the brilliance was so great. And so Moses had to call to them. Moses called to them, "Hey guys, where are you going?" And Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterwards, all the children of Israel came near, and he gave them as commandments all that the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. It was too scary to be around him. They couldn't put on sunglasses, so he had to put on the veil. But whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would take off the veil until he came out. He would come out and speak to the children of Israel whatever he'd been commanded. And whenever the children of Israel saw the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone, then Moses put the veil on his face again, and until he went in to speak with God once again in the tabernacle. So this is probably the reference here to "May God's face shine upon you." This was a reflection of the glory of God. Moses' face reflected that glory, and it was awe-inspiring. It was actually rather frightening for the children of Israel. It was beyond their understanding. Moses' face shone as a reflection of God's brilliance and his mercy. That's the context there. God was merciful. He wanted to bless Israel. And he had a very personal, intimate relationship with his servant Moses. Moses would ask him for things, and God would say, "Okay, I can make that happen for you. You want to see me? I can do that, but only my back, because to see my face would kill you." That's the kind of relationship God can have with his servants, a personal relationship. The shining that happened there with Moses and the children of Israel was in a context of fear. People were afraid. But the context that we see in the Aaronic benediction is not one of fear. It's God's face shining on us with benevolence, with goodness, with gentleness, with love and affection. His face is beaming at us in love, looking at us to watch over us and to bless us. To have someone's face shine on you is a sign of health and abundance and that everything is right and as it should be. Proverbs 16, verse 14 says, "As messengers of death is the king's wrath, but a wise man will appease it, in the light of the king's face is life." When the king's face is lit up and happy to see you, there's life there. If you go in to see the king and he's looking really angry, come back another time. And here we're talking about God's face shining on us. He's looking at us with benevolence, with love, with gentleness. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious. What does that mean? To be gracious. If you look up the word in the Hebrew, it means to have mercy, to be merciful, to take pity, to be kind, to show an act of kindness or compassion, to be generous, to give a large amount of something in abundance. Those are all other ways that we could translate the word that we have here rendered as gracious. And then if we go back to Numbers chapter 6 once again, the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. What is a countenance? We don't use that word very much anymore. Countenance just means face. But the countenance in the Bible is symbolic of one's inner being. Remember when Cain was angry in the Garden of Eden? God asked him, "Why is your countenance fallen? Why are you angry and depressed and upset?" His countenance was a representation of what was happening inside him. I learned this word pretty early on because my dad would ask me that sometimes. If I looked kind of grumpy, he'd say, "Why is your countenance fallen?" I told you we spoke King James at home when I was little. So I learned that pretty early on. Why is your countenance fallen? Lift up your countenance. Lift up your countenance. Symbolic of one's inner being. We can take a couple of examples and look at that. Genesis 31. Let's look there. Genesis 31. Verse 2. This is after God had been taking the cattle and the flocks away from Laban and giving them over to Jacob. Laban was a sneaky fellow and a kind of a cheat, and God fixed it so that the cheater got cheated, I guess we would say in the end. The cattle were coming over to Jacob. And Jacob saw, it says in verse 2, that the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. So a countenance represents your inner disposition, the direction that you're facing. Are you happy about something, unhappy, in favor, against? And Laban's countenance was not favorable toward him as it had been before, because he was losing all of his flocks to him. Psalm 44, there's another reference to it. Let's go to Psalm 44. Psalm 44, verse 3. This is another hymn that we sing pretty often. O God, we have heard. They did not gain possession of the land by their own sword, it says in verse 3, nor did their own arm save them, but it was your right hand, your arm, and the light of your countenance. It's because your face was favorable toward them. You were favorably disposed toward them. You gave them blessings. You allowed them to have that land. They didn't go in and take it for themselves. It was the light of your countenance. And another example in Psalm 89. Just move forward a couple of pages. Psalm 89. Verse 15. Psalm 89, verse 15. Blessed are the people who know the joyful sound. They walk, O Lord, in the light of your countenance. The light of your countenance. They walk in your beaming love for them. That's what this part of the blessing means. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. May God turn and look at you individually with pleasure and affection. One commentary says that an equivalent expression might be, may God turn his face toward you with a gracious smile. And that's, remember, these are God's words. He wrote those. That's the relationship he wants to have with us. That's what he wants to be able to do for us. He wrote it down that way for us. He puts, and then we read, may he also give you peace. And I'm sure you know the word for peace in Hebrew, shalom. Shalom is the common greeting in Israel today. If you meet somebody, people in the street, shalom. That's what they say. It's a kind of a prayer and a greeting and a hope for the future, a very elusive hope. But shalom means more than just the absence of strife. It does mean that, but it means more than that. Shalom has a much fuller sense, the sense of complete well-being, where everything is right and good. Everything is as it should be. That's what shalom means. And that's one of the things that God wrote into the prayer that he wants to do for his people. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you, look at you with a gracious smile, and may he give you completion. May everything be right with you. That's God's wish for us. And then very interestingly, we'll go back to Numbers 6 one more time. Verse 27 says, so they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. They shall put my name. God sort of stamps his name on people and says, these are mine. They belong to me as a special people. The Israelites were like that. And as we're going to see in a couple of minutes, the church, God looks at the church that way as well. But I'd also like for you to notice here just for a moment that God said, I want the Levites, the priests, need to pray this blessing on the children of Israel, and then I will bless them. What do we learn from that? God works through people to help other people. Among his people, he sometimes selects some to be his agents to be a blessing to others or to transfer a blessing to other people. God works through servants whom he chooses to perform certain functions. He's always done that, and he will continue to do that. And it's that way that he blesses his people. Today, that would be the different people who are selected to serve in various ways in the church. Deacons and elders and people who serve in different ways. There are people today in the, I'll say, the greater Church of God, or people at least who claim to be part of the Church of God, who don't like that idea. It bothers them. They don't like to think that anybody is selected to do anything particular. Everybody's got to be exactly the same. That's in the air in our Western democracies. But we should understand that that's not the example we find in the Bible. That's just not the way God has chosen to work. And those examples are very clear. But today, just as back then, God puts his name on his people. He stamps his identity on his people. They belong to him as a special treasure. What an amazing blessing that is, to be able to have that kind of privileged relationship with the God who created the universe. And since the beginning of the church period, much of that gift has been transferred to the spiritual people of God. He was working with a physical nation, and some of those promises are still carrying through. Some of the promises to Abraham are still carrying through the physical line. But now he's working with the spiritual people. And there's been a transferal of that identity of who the people of God are, with whom he is working right now. And the Bible tells us that. 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter 2, verse 9. 1 Peter chapter 2, we'll read verses 9 and 10. You are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praise of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people. We weren't all from the same national background. Come from all over the world. Once were not a people, but now are the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. The church is the group with whom God is working today. He stamps his name on the church and on each individual Christian. And he has the kind of relationship with individual Christians that's talked about in the Aaronic benediction. That's why it's important for us to be aware of that and to see what God wrote about the way he wants to have a relationship with the people with whom he works. Well, they've got the silver amulets opened now, so let's go and see what they found. It took several years, actually, to develop the process of being able to unroll the amulets without destroying them. Finally, the Israel Museum carefully unrolled the brittle little scrolls with the aid of a special liquid that helped them maintain the integrity of these fragile metal documents. When the scrolls were finally unrolled, they measured about 1 inch by almost 4 inches. That's how small they were when they were all unrolled. And they have been restored. And if you go ever to Jerusalem, if you go to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, you can see these scrolls. I've seen them. And they look like this now. These are the two scrolls that were, excuse me, unrolled. The writing was in Paleo Hebrew, not using the Hebrew characters that we would recognize today. They had a different one. And this is what it looked like when they managed to get everything translated. You see all the little hash marks on the side? That's Paleo Hebrew. And they were finally able to translate it and see what it said. What they found was that there were paraphrases from Exodus and Deuteronomy. And then there was a section that said this: "May he be blessed by Yahweh, the warrior, the rebuker of evil. May Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and give you peace." A very concise version of what we've been reading in the Aaronic benediction. In fact, that is what we find on those amulets, is a part of the Aaronic benediction that we've just been studying today. What's even more interesting about this, I mean, that would be very interesting even if that's all there was, but there's more. These amulets have been authoritatively dated to the 600s BC. 600s BC. That means they are 400 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Prior to the discovery of these amulets, the Dead Sea Scrolls were the oldest texts, written texts that we had from the Bible, the actual writings. That was the oldest copies that we had of biblical texts were the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now we have a section here that's 400 years older. Why is that important? It's important because it is an additional proof that the Bible is in fact as old as it says it is. Because there are a lot of people who think they're really smart, and they had all sorts of theories and arguments that Moses didn't really write the first five books of the Bible. They were written during the Second Temple period. They were written maybe 200 BC, 300 BC, way later. Moses didn't write them. You don't need any divine inspiration. This was a later document. But here we have a document. Here we have very small documents from the 600s BC that are quoting from the Pentateuch. So no, those weren't Second Temple documents. Solomon's temple was still standing when these amulets were made. Solomon's temple was still standing when these amulets were made. Daniel had not yet gone into captivity when these amulets were created. He possibly wasn't even born. So what we have here is additional proof that the Bible is what it says it is, that it is as old as it says it is. And all the theories of the supposed experts who had all different reasons why it wasn't really as old as it said it was, well, that's been debunked. And I find it quite interesting, brethren, that the oldest known written text of the Bible preserves a passage where God speaks of his love for his people and his desire to bless them. And I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't decide that that should be something that was preserved. He is the God whom we worship, our Father in heaven, and our elder brother, Jesus Christ. And that's the relationship they want to have with all of us. So I can't think of a better way of ending this sermon than simply to say, "The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious to thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give you peace."